You're listening to Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM in the East Bay, berkeleyliberationradio.net online, and this is Radio Autonomía, Zapatismo in the Bay. We are back with our second live interview of the day. We're going to be talking about the criminalization of dissent, the criminalization of protest, and the recent escalation in state repression against organizers and activists really all over the country, but particularly out here on the West Coast. So we have here with us in the studio Stephen, who's one of the organizers of an excellent event that's happening next week that's called Our Lips Are Sealed, which is all about community organizing in resistance to grand juries and grand jury subpoenas. So I'm going to let Stephen explain to us a little bit more about what that means. It's quite a mouthful. So maybe if you could start by explaining a bit about what the convening of a grand jury means for political organizers. What is a grand jury and what kind of government agencies are involved in this kind of process?
Hi, thank you. So a grand jury process is several things. It's a secret hearing that's convened. It's usually at a federal courthouse. It can either be a state or a federal hearing. And you're subpoenaed to appear before this private jury. It's not like a normal jury trial because there is no judge in the room. And everyone who's a part of this jury has usually been selected because they do not enjoy your presence in this room. It's usually retired people. They're usually wealthy. It's usually all white people for the most part. And you appear at the secret hearing. Your lawyer's not allowed to come into the room with you, so you're there by yourself. And the prosecutor runs the show. So the U.S. attorney basically is the one who does the whole thing. There's no judge in the room. And you're just asked these questions, and you have to answer them. You have no way of getting out of them unless you take the fifth, or you just refuse to answer them. So that's sort of the process of what it's like. How does it happen? It usually happens through some sort of investigation. Usually the FBI is the one who would be involved if it's a federal grand jury. The case in Seattle, it's convened supposedly around acts of property destruction that occurred on May Day at the federal courthouse. And so it was coordinated through local police who've been investigating and surveilling and monitoring anarchist communities in Seattle and the Northwest. And then they've, you know, outsourced some of that work to the FBI and brought the FBI in. And then the FBI are the ones who've conducted the house raids in coordination with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which does a lot of the repression against radical communities lately in the United States. And so they coordinated these raids and then handed down the subpoenas. And then people were served with both search warrants and subpoenas for grand juries during these raids. So that's a little bit about what it looks like and the agencies that are involved and how they sort of coordinate and work with each other.
And so folks that are being subpoenaed to grand juries, are they actually being charged with something or are they just being called on to provide information? Sort of what does it mean to be subpoenaed to a federal grand jury?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when folks are subpoenaed to a grand jury, they're not being investigated for a particular crime. They're technically subpoenaed as witnesses. And so the prosecutor wants to ask them questions about who they know, what kind of events they've been at, what their political organizing has been, basically just questions of associations, who they roll with, the kind of work that they do. So they're not actually there to be charged with anything. What they want is for them to give information which can then hand down indictments. So they're basically used to provide information that can maybe stick to somebody or maybe name somebody who they can be also targeted and possibly subpoenaed but also maybe charged. So that's sort of what that looks like.
And we've heard now that there are two folks up in Seattle that have been imprisoned for being grand jury resistors. This is the phrase that we keep hearing. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these comrades and sort of what it means to resist, to be a resistor in a grand jury process?
Sure. So the two people who are currently in detention in Seattle, they're in a federal detention center outside Seattle. One is named Matt Duran and the other is KDO. And they're two anarchists who've been involved in organizing in the Pacific Northwest. They're in their 20s. They're young kids. You know, they KDO works in a bar in Olympia. Matt is a computer programmer. They don't seem to be very visible organizers in the community. They're just sort of folks who know a lot of different people and are active in certain projects. And so they're currently resisting by not talking. I mean, the number one way to resist a grand jury is not to speak, to not give any information, to not cooperate with the grand jury. And then to be a grand jury resistor really means to be someone who is willing to go to jail to protect their comrades and to not talk to the state.
So we've been hearing a lot about this in the Northwest, right? So there's this federal grand jury convened in Seattle, targeting folks from Portland, Olympia, and Seattle. Why is this important for us to be talking about here in the Bay Area? Sort of what is the urgency of this issue here for us in the Bay Area?
That's another great question. So there's a lot of reasons why this is important for any political organizers really in the Bay Area, but particularly for anarchists and anti-capitalist communities, because there's a lot of similarities in terms of the composition. The people that they're targeting in the Northwest are all anarchists who sort of are affiliated with a lot of the kind of things that we associate with anarchist spaces. You know, they work at info shops or social centers. They're involved in collectives. They organize May Day protests, things like that, and so that it seems like that there's like a sort of pattern in terms of who they're going after. A lot of them have been involved in squats, or they've lived in squats, and we have a lot of that kind of activity here in the Bay Area. I mean, the Bay Area has a very strong and vibrant anarchist and anti-capitalist community, and there's a lot of sort of points of resonance between the communities in Seattle and here, in terms of the organizing, in terms of sort of like the style, in terms of what they look like, and sort of the connections that they have. And so it's a real concern because there has been an intensification of state repression against those types of communities in the Bay Area. I mean, for a very long time, throughout Occupy Oakland, but particularly in the last couple of weeks, in the last month, we've sort of seen the state really ramp up its rhetoric, and then also the way that it's charging people and talking about them. In San Francisco, there was recently this anti-capitalist, anti-Columbus Day action, and 20 people were arrested at it. And sort of immediately after they were arrested, the San Francisco Police Department issued a press release that said that this is a criminal street gang that's operating in San Francisco and the Mission, and then linked them with no concrete evidence to other incidences of political vandalism that have occurred in the Mission over the last couple of months from before May Day to up into early September. And yeah, so that's all I'll say about that, I guess.
And, of course, the media plays a huge role in all of this. You know, here at Radio Autonomía, we're really concerned with the significance and the importance of alternative media to sort of counter that sort of very, I could come up with a lot of words, but terrible, terrible mainstream media and their collusion with the police and with the state. And so what role does the media play in these processes, in these grand jury processes? And can you talk about the role of the media in some of the recent events that you've been talking about here in the Bay Area? Sort of why is the media important to keep our eye on in all of this?
Sure, that's also a really good question. So the media is important for several reasons. I think that in terms of what's happened recently with that anti-Columbus Day, anti-capitalist march, was the way that the media came out against the arrestees sort of indicates how I think the state also wants to treat them. So the SFPD released this statement saying that they were part of this criminal street gang, and then a lot of the mainstream press in San Francisco ran it with the same way, saying, you know, releasing their mugshots, saying meet the Hellraisers who have destroyed the Mission. And I think that sort of what the media is starting to do with the police is starting to sort of build this idea in people's minds that there actually is a criminal street gang, and it's these folks who have been arrested, and they're terrorizing the Mission. And they're sort of using a lot of the same sort of rhetoric and fears and panics and all these things that the state mobilizes to talk about people who are in gangs, and to map that onto these folks who are protesting in San Francisco. So it seems like there's a really intense level of coordination between the police department, who immediately released this press release and gave it to almost every media agency you can imagine, including businesses. I mean, everybody got this press release, and the language of the police department. And they seem like they're sort of working together to make this broader campaign to criminalize this group of people who came together for a march who, you know, that's all they did, and saying, like, this is this group who we think is an actual gang, and now we are moving to talk about them that way, and we're trying to charge them in that kind of way.
Yeah, and we've been following for a long time here on the show the situation with the gang injunctions here in Oakland. So we know that that category of gang, you know, that labeling of gang is an incredibly powerful legal and rhetorical tool that the state and the police really deploy with some force. So, you know, what I'd like to switch to now is a little bit about talking about the significance of the event that's being planned for next weekend in terms of preparing ourselves, right? Educating ourselves, learning and working together to prepare ourselves to know what it means to have this kind of situation of a grand jury, a federal grand jury, come up in our area, but also to know about it in terms of ways that we can be supportive of the folks that are resisting up in Seattle. So we often hear the term security culture, right? Security culture, and it's like this kind of loaded term that it's hard to unpack sometimes. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what this means and maybe what are some of the most important things for people to know about basic security culture, so ways that we can sort of take care of ourselves and take care of our comrades.
Sure. I mean, I think the best way to answer that question is just to look at some current examples. So in San Francisco recently, the police have been giving indications about how they've been charging people and how they've been finding people out who they'd like to investigate more. And there was actually an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think it was yesterday, talking about how the police basically just spend all their time on social media, and that's how they get a lot of the information that they want. And a lot of times, they have just like, you know, whole task force. They have people who are just monitoring what's happening on Twitter and Facebook, and going through that and sort of culling information and seeing who they can get after and who they can indict. So that's one thing about sort of security culture and what it looks like and what we need to be paying attention to. I think that it's really important to be cautious about what you're doing on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, Tumblr, all of it, and to be aware that even if you're not posting things that directly incriminate folks, like pictures from actions or things like that, that even some of the conversation that happens on those places is also tools that the state can use, not necessarily to arrest people, but maybe to intimidate certain people, maybe to subpoena certain people. If they see someone who seems like they're really upset with a kind of action and they're just sort of ripping into everybody who participated in it, that's someone who they may say, oh, they'll probably talk to us at a later date, or we can probably lean on them and they'll give us some information, or, you know, they seem scared or uncomfortable with what's happening and they seem vulnerable, so we're going to target them. Or it may be, you know, oh, this person's just blanketly naming names, and so now we have someone we can indict or investigate or look after.
So with social media, it's kind of a fine line that we have to walk between putting everything out there for the state and not using it as the tool that we know it is, which is a very powerful tool for mobilizing folks and for organizing and connecting and networking. So this event, for example, has a Facebook event, right? So it's not about a complete sort of dismissal of these kinds of tools, but just being wise about how we use them. And remembering that no internet cyber media is secure ever. So I'd love to hear some more about the event that's planned for next Sunday, November 11th. So tell us about the event, what kind of activities are planned, who will be speaking, sort of what folks can expect if they want to plug in with it.
Sure. So the event will be next Sunday, November 11th. It'll be from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Holdout in Oakland. It's at 2313 San Pablo Avenue in West Oakland. And so the event really has been building off of some smaller events that have happened over the last couple of months. There's been a couple of really great events at the Holdout that's, I think, sort of started based around the indictments and the grand jury that happened in Seattle. And there was one event that highlighted resistors, and then there was a smaller event a couple weeks ago that was sort of a very basic training. We had legal workers and other folks talking about security and know your rights trainings and things like that. So this event is building off of those events, and it's a little bit more extensive, and its outlook is a little bit different than those, because those events were very basic, and they were sort of like a sort of panel structure where somebody talks at you, and, you know, you listen and you go away, and that's how it works. So this event is really trying to build up skills for people who attend so they really know what to do, so we can have each other's backs. I mean, one of the things that the Anti-Repression Committee says a lot is that we're all anti-repression. We all need to have these skill sets so we can know how to help each other out. And also just to not panic. I mean, I think it's important that people really don't panic. There's lots of state repression coming down right now. But, you know, the state is always trying to repress us, whether it's communities of color who they're trying to control and manage, or it's activists who are organizing against state repression and capitalism and all those types of things. So so the event is going to be a panel. The panel is going to be very brief. We're going to have a couple of speakers, Christian Williams, who's an author of this book called Our Enemies in Blue, who writes a lot about policing and police in the United States, and is also a member of the Portland Committee Against Political Repression. So he's going to come down and talk about some of the work that he's been doing in Portland in terms of support work around grand juries. Richard Brown, who's a member of the SF8, he's also going to come and talk about how those folks resisted their grand jury and held strong and managed to emerge without any kind of indictments, anything like that. And then there'll also be some legal workers who are going to do some trainings. There'll be a basic Know Your Rights training, as well as a sort of what to do if there's door knocks and things like that, if you receive visits from FBI agents. And then also, one of the things that we sort of noticed in a lot of the other trainings that's happened and talking with folks in the Northwest who've done these trainings before is that certain dimensions of support work haven't really been highlighted as much. So one thing that we really tried to do with this event is talk about things that we thought are sort of not talked about as much. So care work and trauma. A lot of the folks who were raided in the Northwest have extreme PTSD from being a part of a house raid. Some of them also had just trauma from other interactions with the police. So we're going to have someone talk about trauma and what you can do for self-care and community care in the context of things like raids and police visits and stuff like that. And then also someone will come and talk about care and child care issues like that, because you know, when you're subpoenaed, you pretty much have to prepare to go to jail. You know, there's only a matter of time where you'll most likely be, if you're going to resist, have a contempt hearing. So what do you do with your kids? What is the legal dynamic like that work? How can we support folks, resistors who have kids, you know, as a community, things like that. And then there's going to be some conversation sort of about media strategy and how to handle the really intense repression that we're seeing in the media in terms of what happened recently in San Francisco, but then also what's been happening in the Northwest as well. And so we're going to have someone who worked on a documentary about the legacy of torture with the SF8 from the Freedom Archives. I believe his name is Claude. He's going to come and talk about the documentary that he made and sort of the work that we can do to really push back against the state in terms of the narrative. I mean, one thing about a grand jury that really works to the benefit of people who are doing support work and media work around it is that it's a secret hearing. They don't tell you what happens inside of that room. And there's a reason they don't tell you what happens inside of that room, because it's a horrible, horrible, dark hole with no legal protection inside of it. And so the state doesn't want to highlight that the way that it targets you know, communities of color and activists and things like that is through these secret proceedings. So a lot of what we can do in terms of media strategy is just to sort of expose what happens in that courtroom, you know, bring transcripts out, you know, let people know what's happening in there, what the jury composition is like, and letting people know what the judge is doing and saying, and just, you know, sort of generally letting people know what's happening in there. So that's a general overview of what we're going to be doing with this event next Sunday.
Thanks so much. So we encourage everybody to come out to that event and also to the Justice Ballot Bluford Coalition's March on Saturday. I wanted to just kind of wrap up by putting these two together. I think that there's a lot of overlap about secret trials and secret hearings on one end with the federal grand jury, and then on the other end we hear about all the secrecy surrounding the protection of the police. So the role of the media is coming up repeatedly, but just sort of what you know, the role of the community as and you know, community is always a sort of contentious term, but the role of the people, I might say, the people that are out here, the people that are not part of the police force, people that are not part of the FBI. How are we addressing this, and how are we sort of challenging all of the secrecy that shrouds all of the police and sort of state processes? So I don't know if there's any kind of connections that come up that y'all wanted to maybe address.
Sure. This is something that I've been thinking a lot about recently. And the way that I think about it is, so right now, radical communities, anarchists in particular, in the Northwest and also the Bay Area, are being threatened rhetorically as being gang members. They're being talked about that way in the media, but they're not being treated actually as gang members by law enforcement, which obviously I don't want to see. But, you know, they're not experiencing the same kinds of daily harassment, surveillance, intimidation, restriction on movement that, you know, black and brown youth face every day in the city of Oakland and San Francisco. It's just not at that point yet. And so one of the things that we've been trying to do with this panel is actually to learn from those struggles, to learn from the gang injunctions fight, to learn from the ways that folks organized against gang injunctions in the Mission. And we're actually going to have someone who's a paralegal who works with the NLG come on and talk about some of the work that she does with gang cases, to just sort of give people a sense about what it's really like to actually be treated as a gang member by law enforcement and the courts, and to understand what that kind of state repression looks like. And then it happens every day. And, you know, that there are house raids. There was a couple of house raids in July in the Northwest, and that was a really terrible thing. But a couple of weeks ago, there was a house raid in West Oakland for a homicide suspect, where OPD, you know, they shot up the house, they threw flashbangs in, they cordoned off the whole street. There was a SWAT team raid. There was tear gas shot into it. I mean, that's something that people in Oakland experience every day. This is not something that anarchists by and large seem to be experiencing you know, for the duration of the organizing that they're doing. So I think that there's a lot of really important connections to be made between the kinds of strategies, rhetoric, tools that the state, the media, the courts are using to criminalize black and brown youth in terms of gang injunctions and anti-gang policing, and sort of the things that we're starting to see in our own radical communities. And so I think that it's really important to start building those connections, and a lot of that has happened prior in terms of folks working together. Anti-Repression put out a great statement around stayaways and gang injunctions with the Stop the Gang Injunctions Coalition to really draw those connections to different forms of surveillance and social control and repression. And so I think that that's going to be really key in terms of moving forward in the next couple of months about what we do to fight a grand jury or the murder of a black youth like Alan Bluford, and really building our relationships together and making these strong coalitions.
I'm really glad that Stephen went first, because what he said is absolutely perfect, and I don't really have a whole lot more to say on top of that, because I just really want to highlight what I think is important out of what I heard he was saying anyway, which is working together and building bridges and forming coalitions. And one thing that I really feel like that, you said, well, we can always point to the mainstream media as, one of our obstacles, something that we, need to work around or overcome or change people's, blind perception of or blind believing in, whatever it is. But, one thing that the mainstream media tries to do is to divide us. They try to make us think that we're not the same. They label us with labels that they then try to add negative attributes to, like anarchists. I know a lot of anarchists. I myself might be one. And I don't know. So far, I really haven't seen any violence coming out of the anarchists, anyway, that's not really the issue that I'm trying to go here. What I'm really trying to say is that people try to divide us, all of us, from working together. And as soon as we start to realize that, strength in numbers, then we're actually going to start working somewhere in our communities, in Oakland, getting somewhere, making real change. But until we all, until we all stop fighting and until we all join together and realize that we really are all the same, whether or not we're anarchists or we're black or we're white or we're rich or we're poor or we're employed or we're unemployed or we live in Berkeley or Oakland or Richmond or wherever, we're really all the same. And we really all should have one. And it'd be great if we, if we can do what Stephen said, and which is work together.
So I think that's really great. And the last thing that I would only say is that a lot of times in radical communities, we talk about political repression as this thing that's distinct from state repression. We think about like the camp being raided, but we don't think about, like I was talking about earlier, house raids in West Oakland. And I think that as an anarchist personally, as someone who wants to challenge the state and its authority, the only way that we're really going to fight back against the state is if we link up with struggles like the Justice for Alan Bluford Coalition, and if we link up with fights against the gang injunctions, because these are all forms of state control, and they're all forms of repression, and they're all, trying to lock us up in the end of the day. And if we're really going to fight back, that's how we're going to do it, is we're going to work together, and we're going to show, that we're not going to stand for any kind of policing like that. We're not going to stand for any kind of monitoring on how we move and what we do and who we associate with and who our friends are, and that that's none of the state's business to even go after us for that. And so, yeah, that's all I'll say.